Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the politics of Muslim Americans and how might they be changing in the current political environment? And first, hacking, fake news, and paid trolls, both from within the country and from afar. Are they destroying democracy? We are joined by Jennifer Forstall, who's a professor of political science at Stockton University, and by Chris Tenove. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Center for Ethics and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. You both look at a type of threat to democratic processes: hacking, trolling, fake news, sort of corrupted information. So maybe the place to start in a conversation like this is, why are these threats to democracy? What is it that we need in democracy in terms of information, in terms of deliberation, for it to function properly and to maintain it? Chris Tenove, do you want to start?
I'd love to. And that's a great question and exactly the one I've been thinking about. We're learning so much about what happened in terms of what bots were promoting what messages, what kinds of fake news stories were circulated, but we still don't really know their effects. And I think we don't know how to talk about what they're doing to our democracy. So the former CIA acting director, Michael Moore, described these kinds of digital interference as, it's an attack on our democracy, it's an attack on who we are as a people. And I do think we need to think about all the ways in which that might be true. So the way that I am thinking about this is to use one, this is an analogy, but thinking about democracy as people coming to a table. They get a spot at that table in order to vote. That's one way they contribute, but also to advance their views in public discussions, protest, join a civil society group. So there are lots of ways we can get to that table. And then once we're there, we need a kind of conversation that allows, if we don't come to agreement, at least we agree about some basic facts, we agree about what matters, we find out where we can find some overlap in what we want, we identify differences, and we gain a certain sort of trust and respect for each other, or try and maintain it. And then we have to get up from that table and act on that discussion. And so in each of these three sort of phases of democracy, we can see that there's been challenges posed by the different digital techniques that foreign actors and domestic actors have been using.
Like the hacking and like the trolling and the fake news, that sort of a thing.
Precisely.
Yeah, and just the incivility in general, I would think, is part of it as well. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Forstall, what would you add?
So I think a lot of what Chris has said is right on the money. You know, we know that a lot of what we need to make democracy work is not only the sort of good information, we need to be able to identify the things that we need to talk about at that table. We need to know who those people are with that are talking with us. We need to know how to talk to one another to get back to the civility thing. And so, you know, where I come from, which is a little bit different, is thinking about not only sort of how that table might be changing and who the actors are, but also, right, how the table is designed. And so a lot of what these digital technologies are introducing into the conversation is a whole new way of organizing people and publics. And so it's not just sort of the kind of information that we need to be looking at. We also need to be looking at how that information and why that information is being spread the way that it is, sort of how these technologies are bringing us together in new
or
and
not
interesting
bringing us together, I think,
right,
in many cases.
Exactly, how they are organizing or perhaps disorganizing the public.
Dividing in many ways rather than sharing a table, having disparate tables perhaps.
Right, and in some cases, you know, the thing about digital technologies that is not the case in physical space is that you don't often see the table for what it is, right? So many, like there are 2 billion people on Facebook, but you know, we don't all recognize that we're sitting in the same space. We're sort of in, you know, alternate dimensions where we can all see, you know, we're all there, but like we're in different phases of existence, and so we don't really see each other in the same way.
So let's talk about some of these phenomena that you two have been looking at. Maybe we should start with the hacking, because the hacking is done for multiple reasons. Talk us through some of these reasons.
Right. So There are different ways to use this word hacking, for starters. People in the digital technology world often use it in a positive way. You work on a hack of your system in order to get it to do something better or do something different. And that's worth thinking about. Another way is we use hacking just if it has anything to do with an online technology and there's a problem, we call it hacking. So but for me, hacking I use more specifically, at least in the negative context, is system intrusions, usually to access data that people aren't supposed to. And so the most prominent cases we saw in the recent election were the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's communications and the hacking of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta's, his email and communications. And so on the one hand, so this is a clear legal violation of privacy of data, and that's a bad thing to do in an election. But it's not just about, you know, breaking and entering. It's very important is the way those hacks were used. They were very strategically rolled out to maximize attention to them instead of other issues that maybe warranted, you know, greater discussion and action after the election. They were leveraged to sow the greatest distrust possible around some of the people involved, particularly in the, for people of a certain political persuasion. And so it's not just the system intrusion, it's very much that this hacking and getting at people's private data is then used in these ways to undermine, again, the quality of conversation, the ability to talk about other issues.
And the ability to talk across the table at all. And this is hypothesized to have been done by Russians.
There's a lot of things in the way that the system intrusion happened and the way that, technically that it happened, that indicated these Russia-linked groups. The alignment with an overall policy of Russia around the election, around information warfare is maybe strong, but at least information interference, consistent. And then some of the other key information, which we don't know, but we get assurances from intelligence agencies, is some of that more human intelligence and finding out, yes, we have evidence, more specific evidence about orders given or who actually asked for what. But the thing that's so tricky about these things is that there can be different people in this chain. The person who achieves the exploit of a system isn't necessarily the person doing the leaking, right? And so is it possible some are not Russian affiliated? I think, you know, that's possible. Moreover, and again, this is how I mentioned before about how it's domestic and foreign actors, and they often are kind of working together. So when Donald Trump, for instance, says, please hack Hillary's emails, calling for Russian hackers to do so. I mean, that's a very obvious and public way, but there are a lot of ways in which there was a willing domestic constituency to take this information when they get it and advance it. And so, yes, I think it's pretty clear there was a significant contribution of Russian or Russian-supported actors, but it's certainly not them by themselves.
In your paper, you suggested this is not altogether new. It's just kind of risen to a new level and in multiple countries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how pervasive are we talking about?
Information insecurity is absolutely pervasive. We know this from the phenomenal numbers of cybercrime. So data is getting access and use all the time. In fact, most hacks of political groups are probably not leaked because there's huge amounts of state espionage and following each other's conversations that they use in strategic ways but would never leak. The leak of these big parts of documents is fairly new. There's some really good research by a group out of Oxford called the Computational Propaganda Team that has looked at how bots are used in, I think, 10 different countries from Poland to Taiwan to Canada, where I'm from, to the United States. And so we get a pretty good picture, first of all, that's pervasive because these digital platforms are there to be gamed. They have these vulnerabilities, but it is used in different ways. And we can also see that different countries are vulnerable in different ways. So I'll just say one little thing about the French election, which is an interesting comparison to the US one. There was a very prominent, again, leak of hacked documents called the Macron leaks, because at that time, presidential candidate Emmanuel Macron was about to begin the it was the second round of presidential elections when this came out. And it was a strange leak in a way, because it was a huge amount of information. It wasn't actually that much about Macron. There was deliberately introduced falsehoods about Macron in it, so it wasn't revealing necessarily like a big truth. It was doctoring these things and then pretending they were true in order to leverage them. Another thing that's interesting about it is a lot of the bots that were promoting attention to it on Twitter were the same accounts that were being used to promote pro-Trump messaging in the US elections. And they were very ineffective. Partly is the timing, and there was a media blackout then, right before the French election. Partly, a lot of them were writing apparently in English, and so not necessarily persuasive to a French voter. And partly a different political culture, where parties or groups within France may not have been as keen to jump on illegal activity and use it for electoral advantage.
You know, in your paper here at APSHA, you also mentioned issues like self-determination and sovereignty and how these are now at threat too.
I think they are in a few ways. So most basically, you can't think of the citizens of a country as being self-determining if one of the most important acts, which is to decide their government, is interfered in and no longer seen as legitimate by many of the citizens for that result. We don't really know that the outcome would have been different barring foreign actor involvement in the US one, but it certainly has lowered the trust and legitimacy of that. So that's a clear interference of sovereignty. International law struggles to characterize that and provide opportunities to take action on it at the international level, and that's a problem. That's a difficult thing to deal with. But in addition to that, there's things like if a country wants to structure the conversations that people are having within their country, want to develop laws to regulate it, and then a foreign-owned social media company doesn't enforce hate speech laws at the right time or in alignment with what the country wants, you can say that those people aren't able to really be self-determining, democratic citizenry using the processes they want, that they've decided for themselves, because decisions about how they will talk to each other are being regulated elsewhere or decided elsewhere.
Jennifer Forrestal, let's bring you in now. You've been focusing on the proliferation of fake news and the trolling, and how do you see that as within this conversation of, oh my God, what's happening with democracy?
Sure. So again, I'm sort of going to jump off of a lot of the things that Chris says, because what I think that he's pointing to, particularly with a really interesting comparison between France and the United States, right, is that it's more than just the strategies that people are using, and it's more than just the technologies themselves that are available. It's also sort of this, especially this comparison sort of forces us to look at the wider social and political sort of culture, I think is the word you used, that, you know, gives us a context within which propaganda, misinformation, disinformation either works or is successful or isn't, right? And again, as I think you opened the segment, this isn't new, right? Harold Laswell wrote in like 1927 with regards to the First World War that, you know, propaganda isn't about being a good PR person. It's about taking advantage of a disorganized public, right? A bunch of citizens that don't understand how they're connected with one another, that don't have those ties of trust and reciprocity, solidarity. And so, you know, when we think about what to do about this, right, like what does democracy mean in a digital age, a lot of that is sort of how do we build sites and spaces that can sort of recapture or support and maintain those kinds of relationships that give sort of grounding to the hard work of democratic politics, right? How can we make sure that people's ties between citizens aren't totally disrupted with, you know, bad news or sort of things that make you sad that, you know, don't get people running off of Facebook, which happened in the wake of the 2016 election, right? Like, how do we keep people at the table? And so these are sort of questions that I think these problems open up that go beyond just like, we need better information out there.
Okay, so what about the paid end of this? So how do you deal with that? For example, the paid trolls. Both of you have sort of mentioned trolling, and many of them are on somebody's payroll, whether it's a foreign country or a local political operative.
So,
and before you even do that, also be thinking, because we talked earlier about, well, what is the effect of trolling? Maybe you should talk about that first.
Sure. So trolling, in my understanding of it, and this is controversial, there's a million different ways that you can define trolling. And a woman named Whitney Phillips does really great work in this area, so everyone should go read her stuff. But the way that I understand trolling from a particularly political perspective is that this is, it's a particular kind of activity that you engage in with the intention of sort of shutting down a conversation. So democracies need people to continue to want to be at the table, right? The whole idea of democracy is that even when you lose, you'll come back to play again and hope to win another day. And trolls aren't interested in that. And so, you know, paid trolling is a little bit different because they don't seem to have that kind of personal investment. But there are a lot of things that we can do and that we've seen be successful in, again, building tighter knit communities online that can sort of insulate themselves from trolls, so that when the like wrecking ball of a troll comes through and tries to spread hatred or misinformation or death threats in the worst case scenario for women, mostly women of color, then they can sort of heal and protect themselves and say, like, that's not acceptable in this space. And so there, again, there's a lot of other better research on this that sort of does the actual strategies, but a lot of them are things like moderation, sort of posting the rules and making it clear that, you know, that is not how we comport ourselves in this space. So, you know, again, but all of that goes back to thinking about these as more than just sort of bland, you know, internet tubes that send information without any kind of bias or whatever, right? Like, these sites are designed in specific ways. And if citizens are actually going to be sort of the whole democratic citizens taking responsibility for the facets of their lives that affect them, we need to start thinking more seriously about how those sites are constructed and the kinds of communities we want.
Yeah.
Just to add one thing that Jenny presented this week, and that's so smart in her approach to this, is to point out that there are two very broad ways of going about making these spaces better. One is to look at the issues around gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the concern is that conventional journalism and its ethics of professionalism and ability to investigate and disseminate news is being undermined. So we might want to support more of that. We might want to have social media sites doing like a tougher job of regulating what is aggressive or hateful conversation on their sites. We might want them to flag things that are not from where they appear to be. So there's a lot of things that we would ask people to do in the design of the table we're at. Mm-hmm. And then, but Jenny's additional point is, let's not think that's the only answer, because if we do that, then we're surrendering our conversation to these gatekeepers in some way. And so we have to also make sure that citizens themselves are engaging this conversation about how we should be speaking with each other, that I imagine that they're trying out different ways of doing things, and that we're cultivating among citizens some of these, might call it the ethics or just basic respect or civility, you know, different terms for it, but ways of engaging with fellow citizens so that we don't need to be regulated, that some of it is bubbling up.
So, yes, thanks. That's exactly what I'm arguing. But
that's exactly what you said earlier.
Yeah, that's exactly what I presented on Thursday.
He was listening.
But yeah, so, and part of that, right, a big part of that is that when we tend to focus on the problem of misinformation, we focus on the facts. And this was a huge part of our conversation on Thursday, right, is truth and not truth and facts and lies. But facts are really only part of the story. As I imagine any good journalist will tell you, presentation of those facts makes a whole big difference, right? And the audience that you're playing to. And again, sort of thinking about how we cultivate those norms of discourse that teach you how to present facts in a compelling way. And, you know, that again means that we can't allow elites to do that for us, right? The gatekeeping is not enough if we want the sort of robust democracy that I think many of us do.
So you're both quite optimistic about the possibilities.
Maybe.
Optimistic is strong. I would say optimistic that there are opportunities. Mm-hmm. There's definitely it's not the right response to say, now that the internet is here, we are unable to agree on truth and foreign actors will have their way with our elections.
Right.
That's absolutely not true. On the other hand, there's a lot of difficult things that need to be done and innovations that are needed in order to address these issues.
So I wonder too, when you've got all of these simultaneous threats that are coming from technology, really information technology, and then at the head of a country like the United States, you have a guy like Donald Trump who is then adding to it with his own disinformation and simultaneously attacks on traditional journalism as fake news. Granted, they're not perfect and they make a lot of mistakes and they're kind of narrow in their perspective, but at least they try to fact check. These are big problems. And when I speak with, you know, average voters who may have been engaged, they're like, we don't know what to believe. They throw their hands up in the air like, what do we do? What's your response, Jennifer?
Oh, man. I think that's a good question, right? And it's clearly, again, one that we've been grappling with for at least 100 years, right? Like, again, I'm a political theorist. I study the history of political thought. And this is a problem that, like, at least dates back to the early 20th century with the guys I'm reading. It definitely dates back millennia, right? Like, this is just a problem of politics. And so, these sites are here to stay. And so in some cases, I don't know that optimism or pessimism is the way to go. And it's just sort of like, what can we do to use them to make people feel less that way, less hopeless and disorganized? And again, the strategy that I am taking as my small part of that scholarly endeavor is to think about how we can design Facebook better, how we can design Twitter better, right? So I don't think it's a coincidence that disinformation spreads particularly fast on Twitter and spread very quickly on Facebook, not only because they're widely used, but also because of the structure of those sites, right? And, Facebook, I think, realized that after 2016 and is thinking more about their sort of obligation or responsibility to the public. And I think, you know, there's a lot that we then can do as experts in this to help them with that conversation, so.
And I'd just say that there are vicious circles, but also virtuous circles possible in this area. So the vicious circle that I've been looking at is there are these vulnerabilities in our politics and how we communicate online and the digital technologies more broadly that foreign actors are taking advantage of and making us more distrustful of each other, of the truths that we put forward and so on. And that then sort of incentivizes domestic actors and parties and politicians to continue to act as badly and take advantage of it. But the virtuous circles are possible as well. So if sites respond to that problem and design themselves a bit better and increase the range of views, considered views that we encounter, then we start having better conversations about how to regulate it. And then with better regulations introduced in campaigning, we are more trusting of our political figures and hold them to a higher standard of behavior than some. We're in a vicious circle now, and getting to that virtuous circle is tricky, but it can build on itself, I hope.
Well, I add to that, because I study traditional media, that the traditional media norms, which are designed to be attention-getting, are the things that may have led us down this path. You know, soundbite, dramatic, conflict orientation, and so these have become the eye catchers, and so it's the economic model that kind of made it that way. And so then when you translate, well, Twitter and Facebook and all of these others are also in the economic model, which is you have to have people paying attention in order to get your stock priced a little bit higher. So with that in mind, is it the model that's broken?
Like, the model of capitalism is sort of where we got to. Yeah, it seems like these conversations always go there. So I guess I will start answering that question in much the same pragmatic mode that I answered, I think, the optimism-pessimism question, which is like, sure, maybe capitalism is actually the root of all evil. Marx was right. But I think that it might be here to stay. And so, you know, again, I think the more interesting and actually more difficult question is, you know, within these confines, what can we start doing to make it better, much as Marx would hate that answer, right? What band-aids can we put on this problem? Again, like, I think that's where a lot of this work is kind of trying to go, right? It's not, Facebook is here, right? And so again, sure, we can criticize that, and I think we should continue doing that, right? If your bottom line is monetizing our identities and our demographic boxes, like, that's maybe a problem, and we can talk about that. But simultaneously, we also need to be talking about what they can be doing in the interim to make those sites not so terrible.
Yeah, and I just add, people are not just going to turn off their computers one day. They need alternatives that they move to. So a lot of people are very frustrated with what they've got. I think many people would pay rather than having purely ad-driven models for some platforms. They would pay to get journalism, to get opportunities to communicate with fellow citizens that is more fulfilling, that doesn't leverage their anger and other emotions as quickly, that doesn't cheapen the conversation. And so I think we need to make sure there are alternatives out there.
And there are. I mean, going back to traditional media, I've been thinking a lot recently about NPR, right? Like, that, again, is a model that does a lot to, like, build local communities, to make sure to contextualize information that can seem very overwhelming when you're just getting it in a straight information overload on Twitter. But again, it's sort of a smaller kind of very cultivated and sort of long sustained kind of news spreading that is connected but distinct and can, again, tailor information a little bit better to the communities of interest that it knows that it serves, without perhaps doing disservices. And so, you know, maybe it needs to be public funded. That's also something that we haven't talked about at all.
But yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, but I do think, again, there are models
out
there.
You guys have it in Canada.
And I don't know that Facebook is going to go, you know, nonprofit or become the state social media. But again, I think that even when we talk about traditional media versus new media, there are, I think, interesting models that we can use. Even within that.
Yeah, I think the last thing that we didn't get to that I wanted to is about destroying the trust in the very system. In other words, if people don't trust their democratic government or their democratic processes or their sources of information, is that a way of, say, a foreign entity to then destroy really essentially the fundamentals of a country?
Yes, it is, and it is a strategy that some governments have intentionally employed in the past. It's a great way to weaken an opponent, to achieve what you want because they're distracted and turning against each other. And this is both historical, we could have come up with many examples, and it's the way many people describe the information operations of Russia, but it's not only Russia that tries to take advantage of conflicts within different citizenry in other countries in order to get what they want.
Well, thank you both so very much. Chris Tenove and Jennifer Forrestal, it's been a great pleasure to host you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Forrestal is a professor of political science at Stockton University. Chris Tenove is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Center for Ethics and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. When we come back, the politics of Muslim Americans. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the politics of Muslim Americans, and how might they be changing under the current political environment? With us is Emily Khoury-Toma. She's research fellow at Northeastern University's Middle East Center. And Aubrey Westfall. She's a professor of political science at Wheaton College. Welcome to The Scholar Circle. And you're doing research in a fascinating new area. Political scientists have really failed to look at the politics of Muslim Americans. So why don't we start there? Why this absence, do you think?
I think there are a couple reasons. The first is that I think we don't have a great handle on how big the population is in mm-hmm. the United States yeah. because we don't collect data on religious affiliation in the census. And of course, Muslims have all sorts of overlapping identities, so they are also racial minorities or not. And so when we think about identity politics with Muslims, it's complex mm-hmm. and it's multifaceted.
Precisely. And I think that most people became aware of the American Muslim community post 9/11, of course. So they went from being this sort of invisible community to a very visible American minority. So I think that has had both positive and negative consequences for the Muslim American community. And we're seeing it again with the current election cycles, where they've become a very visible minority group.
But visible for a different set of reasons than what you are advocating that we need to be looking at.
Yes, visible for a different set of reasons, mostly from the perspective of threat. That's the framework in which Muslim Americans have become visible mm-hmm. in the minds of most Americans.
In fact, those of us who work on American Muslim politics are very excited about the new Pew Research survey, which was just released in July of this year. And it tells us a little more about this story that we're trying to sort of examine, right? Muslim Americans, and in particular during these election cycles. And what we know from that survey is that the great majority of them perceive a great sense of threat. And this threat is both constructed by elites who have made Muslims a focus of elections. Also, there's a wide variety of media representations plays a role. Elite discourse, as I just said, and social and political queuing.
Yes, and foreign policy, too.
Yeah, so Aubrey Westphal, you mentioned earlier about the complexity. I mean, it's almost like saying Christian Americans, because there's mm-hmm. so many different ethnic mm-hmm. identities mm-hmm. within Christian Americans, but there's also all of these different factions within Christianity. And so it's hard to just see Muslim Americans
as a monolith.
Exactly.
Yes, they're not a monolith. It's the most diverse minority group that we have in the United States. Right. And of course, within the Muslim faith, there's also great diversity, denominational diversity, diversity in terms of how devout or how dogmatic your belief system is, and also the cultural practices and the way that those cultural practices translate into their faith practice is different.
And in their politics.
And in their politics.
Which is what you were working on. It's like, what about the politics? Mm-hmm. So what about the identity formation, for example? It's not a monolith, but is there a Muslim American identity that does have cohesion? Emily? That's
a really excellent question, and it's one that I try to begin tapping into in my own work. I look at the role of Muslim American interest groups, organizations, because I think that they are playing a very important role in communicating this sort of unified identity. I'll go back to the point I made in the beginning, that I think post 9/11 threat has given this community a sort of communal aspect, and that matters. In addition to what Aubrey said just briefly, 58% of American Muslims are first-generation Americans, and about 18% or so are second-generation Americans. So they're a largely immigrant group as well, and this matters when we think about their political incorporation, their political participation. Citizenship rates are very high, so 80% of Muslims are U.S. citizens, and that's great. However, not all of them are registered to vote, mm-hmm. right?
So what percent do you know is registered to vote?
I think it's about 60%.
So it's about the same as the rest of America.
They actually look very much like ordinary Americans in their political behavior. And that's what my work actually shows. I've done some work on Muslim American identity and on political participation. And one of the main themes of the work is that Muslim Americans are Americans. Mm-hmm. They behave just like Americans in almost every respect. Their identities are a little different. One of the most interesting thing about the Muslim American and the Muslim groups internationally is that they do strive for the creation of a cohesive community globally. My co-authors and I, in our forthcoming manuscript, argue that the American Muslim community is a microcosm for the creation of this diverse global Muslim community. And we look at how the headscarf in particular becomes a vector through which Muslim Americans can identify each other within this diverse community, and a symbol around which they can unify and participate.
Although it's not necessarily unifying because not everybody wears one.
No, and not everyone wears it the same way.
Right.
Different cultural groups wear their headscarves very differently.
And then there is, of course, when you look at foreign policy, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. and lobbying mm-hmm. on foreign policy, so much of the divisions overseas mm-hmm. are dividing Muslims. So how do they lobby on these issues?
Yeah. Well, I would argue that, in fact, we see that some of the foreign policy issues are unifying Muslims, because one of the things that most Muslims agree on in the U.S. is that terrorism is one of their main sort of concerns. Overwhelmingly, about 90% of the Muslim American community points to terrorism overseas as a concern to them personally. Both because it impacts them as Americans, as Aubrey was saying. It impacts how other Americans are perceiving them. Now, on other issues, there's a little more disagreement. The recent Syrian conflict and refugee crisis is something that a lot of Muslims, not only those who are from the Middle East, but Muslims, you know, in general, have mobilized around. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is another issue that the community has mobilized around, although there's overwhelming support for a two-state solution. So again, it's a complicated picture. It's a mixed picture where you see some areas of, you know, cohesion and agreement and some areas of disagreement.
And Emily's work actually shows us the power of the recent elections in mobilizing the Muslim American community through their interest groups. And it seems that those interest groups worked toward getting out the Muslim vote, making the Muslims a visible political bloc, and engaging them in this climate of discrimination, really, and to push back against that discrimination in the current domestic climate, in addition to these foreign policy issues.
Well, so let's talk about that bloc or blocks. A lot of times with ethnic group lobbies, they do tend to end up in the same cities, even in the same neighborhoods, and so they can influence individual members of Congress or their state legislatures. Is that what you see in both voting blocs and lobbying?
In the case of Muslim American lobbying, we have a number of national level organizations. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is the largest Muslim civic organization, right, working on these kinds of issues. There are others, MPAC, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and recently the U.S. Council on Muslim Organizations, which was established as an umbrella organization to try to bring some cohesion, not only to the community, but to these various local level organizations, community center, mosques that are trying to mobilize the community. So there's a lot of energy, and I think this is something that Aubrey brings up a lot in her work, that this diversity and this difference of opinions and practice, it's also very energizing.
Yes, and it's exciting for them to see their voices at the national level. It's a little more difficult, I think, at the subnational level mm-hmm. because, unlike many other minority groups, the Muslim American population is relatively spread out. There are concentrated Muslim communities in the United States, obviously outside Detroit and Dearborn and Houston and New York and Chicago, but they are increasingly spread out across the United States. So that makes mobilization difficult. It's a challenge. And they are only 1-2% of the American population. So there's a numbers issue in that regard.
This is a very important point. Public opinion data shows that most Americans think that the number is much higher, that there are 40 million. I've seen polls where Americans think that there are 40 million Muslims. And this goes to perceptions of threat, mm-hmm. of immigrants coming and taking over. All these debates about Sharia law, which is also sort of this implicit Islamophobia that we're seeing emerging. So it's very important to highlight that, yes, they comprise a small minority, a meaningful minority, but nevertheless, about 1% of the total U.S. population.
And a diffuse minority.
Correct.
Which makes it harder to have electoral impact.
Yes.
Because they can't build in a particular community to
get a majority in any
elect and
community.
Unelect
no.
people, right? Yeah. Yeah, and campaign in that way.
Yeah. It's not unheard of, but it certainly is difficult.
Yeah, it can be swing voters for sure.
And what the Muslim American organizations will tell you is that precisely it matters, because in places like Florida, Michigan, swing states, even though they're such a small number, they may be large enough to make a difference. So I think that's where a lot of the efforts are based.
Yes, some pundits called them the swing vote. So they are perhaps big enough in number in certain communities to make a real difference.
I just wanted to add that as we're speaking about the Muslim American community and their potential political impact, we also, I think, should keep in mind that it's not only about this 1% that we're directly referring to, but it's also about the coalitions that they're building. Mm. And that's something really important when we think about political impact.
What are the coalitions? You mean within the Muslim community or
both?
Beyond?
I would argue both.
What about beyond? What are the groups that they are primarily coalescing with?
Yeah. I think that what we saw emerging and really strongly in this election is interfaith dialogue and interfaith coalition building, in particular with the Jewish American community. Mm-hmm. The way I like to put it is that Islamophobia and anti-Semitism are really two sides of the same ugly coin. And I think both communities are increasingly aware of that and therefore working together to respond to this. I mean, most of the events taking place within the Muslim American community are taking place, the ones I've attended recently, are Jewish community centers, right? And I think there's a lot of potential there. Also, I mean, the African American community, the Latino community. And I think Aubrey's work also speaks to this very directly.
Aubrey?
Yes, we do find that you have these natural coalitions, especially among faith groups, where they are able to put aside historic differences, perhaps over the Israeli-Palestinian issue, yeah, and to come together in this domestic political climate for the same cause. And we see interesting co-optation of strategies, particularly of civil rights strategies, mm-hmm, in the Muslim community. Sometimes explicit comparisons made between civil rights strategies and the Muslim political strategies. Mm-hmm. They see their activism as firmly within the framework of American historic political participation. They see historic parallels to the situation that they're going through right now, and they use those connections to assert their Americanness and their right to stand up against the discrimination with their Jewish brothers and sisters.
You know, it almost sounds like there is an unseen unifying effect of Donald Trump, yeah, rather than just a division effect. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. I mean, this the fieldwork that I've done, right? Speaking to members of the community, to leaders within the Muslim American community, you will hear this theme over and over again, that these elections have really woken us up. They have really mobilized us in a way that we haven't seen since the post 9/11 backlash. And this is a theme that I'm, at least in my work, explicitly hearing, mm-hmm, over and over again. So I think the real question will be how long, right? What will be the long-term impact, mm-hmm, right? A year from now, 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen.
And how long can you continue fighting when you feel, correct, that the establishment is working so hard to divide you and bring you down?
One of the things that you said earlier was that the Muslim American community looks very much like the average American voter in political behavior. Can we break down similarities and differences, would you, between, say, the Muslim American political groups versus other ethnic political groups? Is that possible?
The Muslim American community is generally better educated and financially more stable and higher income than other minority communities. So they come in with higher physical and political capital than other minority groups. Even so, they participate in voting, for example, at a rate slightly below that of Native Americans, but above other minority groups. So I think, again, it's hard to make generalizations because there are all sorts of demographic minorities within the Muslim community, but they are well situated to participate and do participate.
Emily?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And I think that also, if we look at the issues that they care about, they're very similar to the issues that the general American, you know, population cares about and that other minority groups care about. The economy is the number one issue for American Muslims. That's not surprising, right? Access to healthcare, right? Jobs. And what I find most interesting is that although a great majority, about 80% of them, are concerned about the direction that the country is going in, an equal number, right? So about an equal number of them, about 80%, also are satisfied with the ways their personal lives are going. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something really important to think about.
They have high life satisfaction,
yeah,
and they tend to be very optimistic, yes, about their prospects in this country. So they see themselves as being in a good place. In my research with focus groups, we spoke to women who often said, I feel that I am much better off here in the United States than I would be wherever my family came from. So there is that optimism and that engagement and that desire to be part of the American community that match Native Americans.
And they also very much believe in the American dream, the quote-unquote American dream. They will tell you overwhelmingly.
Don't tell them that it's dead.
Yes, overwhelmingly they will tell you that if you work hard, you can make it in this country. And I think that's the energy that we see from immigrant communities in general, and we're seeing it from the Muslim American community in particular.
These days.
Sure. But one that is strong in mobilizing a lot of, you know, minority groups in particular.
And one that they think they've experienced in their family histories and in coming to this country.
What about party affiliation? Is there a tendency to move to one or the other?
Overwhelming.
Party?
Yes.
Okay, tell.
It wasn't, they were actually majority Republican before 9/11, but after 9/11, they moved overwhelmingly into the Democratic Party, but not without some discomfort. So the Muslim Americans I've talked to have said, I have real issues with some of the moral, social policies promoted by the Democratic Party, but I cannot imagine aligning myself with a party who uses Muslim Islamophobia as a political tactic. And so for them, that priority overwhelms their party affiliation, and they are overwhelmingly aligned with the Democratic Party. Although I will say that they also don't affiliate at about the same level as your average American. So about 30%, between 30 and 40% of Muslim Americans, they choose not to identify with a political party.
When you talk about the moral issues they find they can't align with in the Democratic Party, is that things like abortion choice and rights for gay people?
I think they would just more naturally align with the conservative social values represented by the Republican Party. But yes, I've had some research participants express discomfort with the what they perceive as morally loose platform, with platforms that allow for single parenthood, that don't promote what they perceive as nuclear family values, homosexuality, these kinds of things.
So it is sort of the traditional religiosity coming through.
Socially conservative is really the best way to describe, I think, their leanings. Although, yes, as Aubrey mentioned, in 2000 was the first time that we saw Muslim Americans voting as a bloc, and they voted overwhelmingly for George W. Bush. And in the following elections, that switched completely, where you saw over 80% of the Muslim American community voting for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So a very clear rupture in their party affiliation. Another interesting, I think, thing to think about, especially when we think about how they perceive these social values, is that these perceptions shift. They're not static. And their perceptions on issues, for example, LGBTQ issues, has shifted over the past few years, right? From 2012 until now, the data from Pew shows that they are becoming more accepting of the LGBT community. It's a community that is very much in flux, as all communities are, and that's important to think of as we try to sort of, you know, place them.
Yes, you do find very pro-LGBTQ Muslims who align those interests with the civil rights and civil liberties that they see themselves as fighting for. So they can be consistent in that and fight for rights for everyone, even if they religiously wouldn't adhere to those kinds of lifestyles.
And this is certainly what the Muslim lobby groups are doing.
Yes.
The Muslim organizations that I examine are certainly doing this, right? Promoting the rights of all marginalized communities, highlighting how the promotion of their community's rights are intertwined with the promotion of all marginalized people's rights. And I think that's an important strategy, right?
Yeah, building coalitions across those diverse groups.
Now, when you said they voted overwhelmingly for George Bush initially in 2000, and then when Barack Obama ran, they flipped over and went to Barack Obama, do we know now if they maintained the Democrat lean when Donald Trump ran?
Oh, yes. About two-thirds of the Muslim American vote in these past elections went for Hillary Clinton. So about 66% of Muslims voted for the Democratic candidate.
66%?
Yeah.
So there were still more than about a third that
they're unidentified. You still have about 15 to 18% who are Republican, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the rest who are sort of politically unidentified.
How do they make sense of affiliating themselves with the Republican when the head of the Republican Party is sort of anti-Muslim? How does that make sense?
Like with any voter, I think they have their priorities. Mm-hmm. And when they see their priority as perhaps the economy or yes. reducing the size of the government, they will vote for the Republican candidate. Others might prioritize anti-discrimination and they won't vote for a candidate who's been seen to demonize their population. It depends on what your political priorities are. And like with any voter, yes. they'll vote based on those priorities.
And what about gender? I saw there was a paper on your panel on gender. Was it yours, Aubrey?
It was mine, but we changed the topic when the data didn't work out the way we expected it to.
Well, what did you expect? What did turn out?
We expected that we would see greater divergence in gendered behavior, gendered political behavior, and we didn't see great divergence along the lines of gender. The women in our sample weren't much different than the men in our sample when it came to their political behavior in the models that we were using. I hope to continue to explore this. We do see slightly lower rates at a descriptive level of female participation compared to male participation within the Muslim community. That's not unusual within socially conservative religious communities. So I don't know that there's a unique story to tell in the Muslim American community. But Muslim American women embrace norms of feminism and political activism, and they are especially active here in the United States, where you see women taking leadership roles in the mosques mm-hmm. and asserting themselves in the public spheres. We have female Muslims running for office here. So they are a very engaged female community.
What about running for office? What are we seeing there?
So I think that these organizations began the past decade or 15 years, they have really focused their efforts on get out the vote campaigns, right? Registering Muslims to vote, teaching them about their civil rights and how they can make an impact in their communities. In recent years, they also began encouraging them to run for office. I think the community is realizing that as much as we vote for, you know, whichever candidate and try at the policy level to influence policy, we have to be in politics if we want to really have any real impact. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing, at least at the organizational level that I examine, very concerted efforts to encourage people to vote and to run for office.
Have you seen an increase in representation by people being elected from the Muslim American community?
And I haven't looked at it
precisely
specifically. Yeah. And I think, you know, the cases are still low. In Massachusetts, there's a young politician. He's from MIT, mm-hmm. a graduate from MIT, and he was recently elected at the local level for office. His name escapes me right now. And there are other cases.
But we have some in Congress.
A few in the House.
Of course. Yeah.
And a senator.
Yes.
They're few in number, but when you consider the size of the population, it's actually...
It's representative.
Yeah, I would say representative. Mm. But these efforts are an effort to mainstream and normalize Muslim Americans mm-hmm. in the eyes of the non-Muslim American community. So there's this real push to maybe disproportionately represent Muslim mm-hmm. Americans, both in politics and in the media, where we're making a real effort, we see a real effort in these interest groups to put Muslims in very visible positions mm-hmm. at the community level and at the national level.
When there are areas of disagreement, Syria, for example, or in the collaboration with the Jewish community on Israel and mm-hmm. Palestine, how are those getting resolved? Or are they just being pushed aside for the sake of unity on something else?
I think there's a lot of exciting dialogue taking place, both within the Muslim American community and, you know, between the Muslim American community and these other minority groups. And I think that there's a lot of engagement. As I said before, there's a lot of energy. When you attend these events and you speak to, you know, American Muslims, you see in them sort of an eagerness right, to build these bridges and to think in creative ways about not only the problems that they face, but the solutions. That's really, I think, the most encouraging thing. Mm.
I agree. I've read some testimonies that suggested that there was a general agreement to say, we'll put aside our differences mm-hmm. for now because we're in a critical moment. Mm-hmm. But now the hope is, since they've created this social capital, we'll be able to use it for these previously irreconcilable differences mm-hmm. and push this social capital forward so that we can reach some negotiated solutions or agreements or at least continued yeah. coordinated efforts here in the United States.
Do you know if it's happening in other countries as well? I know you focus on the United States, but, you know, Muslim Americans here, but there are also European Muslims mm-hmm. integrating there. Do you yes. know if there's similar things happening?
This is actually one of my next research projects. We're looking at a comparative study of Muslim political behavior in 5 or 6 advanced industrial democracies. I suspect that we don't see quite the same thing. I think the American Muslim community is unique in its diversity and in its political positioning, and that creates special opportunities here in the United States that they don't have in the same way internationally. The Muslim communities are also much bigger in Europe. So the Muslim populations in France and Germany and the United Kingdom hover at around 10% of the population. That's a substantial minority group. So they may not need to build these coalitions or these bridges to the same extent that our Muslim American community needs to.
Yeah, and I would add to that I think that the context of the U.S. in particular is also very different to what we see, for example, in France. We are, you know, we spent a great deal of time discussing Islamophobia and anti-Muslim discrimination, very important issues. But we also, I think it's important to recognize that Muslims in the U.S. are very well integrated, as Aubrey said, socioeconomically, politically, in comparison to other, you know, countries, especially France, the UK. The U.S. context is much more positive, I would say. And
yes.
this allows them to sort of mobilize in more meaningful ways.
Yes, socioeconomically, the Muslim populations in Europe are disadvantaged relative to the native populations, but that is not the case here. In fact, Muslim Americans outperform your average American socioeconomically. And until 9/11, yeah. they were almost a model minority in their integration.
Well, Aubrey Westfall, Emily Khoury, it's great to have you with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thanks.
Emily Khoury Toma, she's a research fellow at Northeastern University's Middle East Center. And Aubrey Westfall, he's a professor of political science at Wheaton College.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.